Good morning. Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. If you missed it, there is Santa Claus and his kettle outside at the table, and so if you would like to donate to the Christmas Bureau, it would be very much appreciated. We'll make sure that the donations get to the Salvation Army this week so that they can use it to supplement the funds that they need to provide for the needy. And there are a lot this year has been the trend. So thank you very much. This is our last program of 2011. We will resume in 2012 on February 2nd. And we already have some great programs lined up. And I will save that for later. But in February, one of the topics that we will be talking about is refugees, which I'm giving you heads up. The Onondaga Citizens League is going to be tackling that whole question in the spring. So we'll be focusing on that somewhat. Thanks to a suggestion from Peter Dunn, we're going to have Marianne Schmidt-Carey from the Say Yes program in the spring also, and several others are lined up. So that's just to give you a heads up for the spring. February 2nd, we'll be back. So I want to wish you in advance a happy holiday and a happy new year. Today, we had a slight change in program. We were going to be talking about the Philharmonic, but Ann Clark and Jeff Komenich, who are going to be our speakers, had a change in travel plans, had to leave for New York this morning. So instead, we have two other artists. We have an art-related theme, and Mark Nurenhausen and Josh DeCaney. Josh is a part-time instructor of percussion in the College of Visual and Performing Arts at SU, and he's also the interim director of the Center for Live Music in the 21st Century there, and he'll be telling us about that. Josh has played percussion with numerous artists. He plays music of Americana from in jazz, world music. He's traveled extensively throughout Brazil and South America. He's also played with many bands in Central New York. Maybe some of you have heard him on one of the couple of dozen recordings that he is on. He also leads the Samba Laranja, the Syracuse University Brazilian Ensemble, and he directs the drum line of the SU Pride of the Orange Marching Band. That's Josh DeCaney. Yeah, I knew that would get them. Mark Nurenhausen is a professor of practice and founding director of the Janklow Arts Leadership Program, which is a new interdisciplinary graduate degree program in the College of Arts and Sciences at SU. He comes to us from Dallas, Texas, where he was president and CEO of the AT&T Performing Arts Center there, which consists of five different performance venues. Before that, he was president and CEO of the Broward Center for the Performing Arts in Fort Lauderdale, and previously executive director of the Maui Arts and Cultural Center in Hawaii. So please welcome Mark Nurenhausen and Josh DeCaney. Thank you.
When Josh was introduced and the drum line was mentioned, everyone's going, ooh and ah, smart man. And when Sandra mentions Maui, Hawaii, and everyone's looking at me here, everyone's going, what's wrong with this guy? So I'm going to try to redeem myself and show that I do have some common sense after all. So, but I want to thank you for having us both here today, because it's very appropriate here during the holiday season. It's a season that's defined a lot by culture, not just religious culture, but it's when people experience music, they think of music, they think of visuals, even if it's lawn decorations, we're visually oriented this time of year. It's a cultural, artistic time of year. And so it's very appropriate today that we're introducing to you a couple different things. There's the program specifically that we do. But before I turn it over to Josh to have him talk about his program, and before I talk about the Janklow program, I want to just give us a little bit of background, because the arts are very important. We all know that. We love the arts. But the arts have changed a lot in America in the last 30, 40, or 50 years. those changes a lot of times are being perceived as negative changes. We are very aware of arts organizations, institutions, established organizations running into financial trouble. We hear about the orchestras that are going bankrupt. We see it in our own community. We hear about museums that have closed or opera companies that are in trouble. But at the same time, though, we can't lose sight of the fact that the arts have enjoyed a tremendous growth over the last 40 years. There are many, 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 many more arts organizations than ever before. We see it at all different scales. It's not just the large institutions, but it's the small arts organizations and culture really infusing our community. We see that the other sectors of the world have recognized the value of the arts. We talk now about very, very naturally about cultural tourism. Urban planners spend lots of time figuring out how to create arts districts. We see how architects and designers are planning urban centers around arts activity. So we have this interesting contrast going on. On the one hand, we go, woe is us, all these arts organizations are going bankrupt, the sky is falling. But yet we turn around and we realize, wait a minute, the arts are more important in our life and more common in our life than ever, ever before. And the question that we face now is, how do we account for those changes? How do we deal with those changes? How does that affect management and what we do within cultural organizations? And finally, I think, and most importantly, is how do we as a community react to these issues? What should we expect out of arts and culture? What should we expect? How should we expect to be involved in arts and culture? What does this all mean? Because the old models have been tipped upside down. It's no longer the case where, you know, if I'm a young middle manager, I expect that I'm going to get my season tickets to the symphony and my season tickets to the theater, and Friday night is symphony night and Saturday night is theater night, and that's how I'm involved in culture. That doesn't happen anymore. It's very, very different. It's not bad. It's not good necessarily. It's just different. So how do we manage in that age of difference? How do we experience culture in that age of difference? And what role does culture play in our life in this new coming age of differences? Those are some of the things that the issues that we want to talk about today, and we're going to begin by talking about the fact that the university has got two new programs that address this. And the first one is Josh's program, the Center for Live Music in the 21st Century. I always got to be careful there. So I'm going to turn it over to Josh and let him talk about the center.
Well, good morning, everybody. Can you hear me out there? Okay. So the Center for Live Music in the 21st Century is a brand new center that I'm the interim director of, just began just a few months ago. Started by Dean Ann Clark from the College of Visual Performing Arts and our new director of the Settner School of Music, Dr. Patrick Jones, who just started this year. So we're very excited about having him in. So the center is an arts incubator and research center. At present, again, like I said, I'm the interim director. I'm getting some assistance from some students, but it's really been on me to give the center legs and start giving it direction in terms of what exactly the center is doing. I can give you an idea of where we're beginning and where our direction is by just letting you know about a few of our clients. One client that we've been working with is a student group called the Think Tank for Arts Entrepreneurship. That is a student group that's registered at Syracuse University. Was started by a student, one of our senior Bachelor of Music students, who is very interested in arts administration and arts organizations. And so we are starting conversations with her in ways to help the student group on campus bring about not only musicians, but visual artists, dance, the various aspects of the arts with the students to bring them together to start thinking about what they can do to further their careers in the arts and think of that in terms of entrepreneurship and really focusing on the equilibrium of business and arts. And this is one of the things we'll get to more later. So that's one of our clients. Another client was Francis and Betty Fang. They represent a group called PEC. We just helped them present a Christmas concert just the other evening. They're a couple, they're Chinese immigrants. They have lived in the United States for about 20, 30 years, have raised their family here, and have a very successful business in language. They train a lot of special forces, military servicemen and women in language. So, for example, they were working with a general last week who is getting ready to go to the Middle East, and he needs to work on his Arabic. So they have one-on-one computer services with him, sort of like Skype. If you've seen Skype, where you have the video and the audio, it's a more high-tech version of that. They do these language trainings for people, obviously, who was extremely vital that they can communicate in these languages for their own survival. So that's their business. They bought a new a church that went out of service on James Street near downtown. It's called Inspiration Hall. So they were our second client, and we helped them present the concert, help come up with a program, help come up with graphic design, help come up with what music they would do, and how to get the students involved with that. So it ended up being a sing-along of traditional Christmas music, which was their vision. So those are a couple of our clients. Certainly our most visible client is the Syracuse Philharmonic. So what we have been doing for them, I've been presenting a series of public conversations. Have you been able to attend any of those? Anybody here? We did one in Fayetteville a couple weeks ago where, on behalf of the Syracuse Philharmonic, I've been speaking to the public about programming and specifically getting into the nitty-gritty of what is it people in Central New York are willing to come out and hear in terms of symphonic music? What do they want to go? What are they willing to spend their hard-earned dollars on to go see? We see the usual suspects of the classics, of European art music. We have the pops. We have a little bit of jazz. So it's been very interesting to get to speak to the public on behalf of the Philharmonic and hear what it is people want to. What it is they want to hear. And like I mentioned a few weeks ago, we spoke in Fayetteville at the Fayetteville Free Library. We spoke to the parents of the Syracuse Youth Orchestra and Syracuse Youth String Orchestra, which, of course, those two organizations were started to go defunct when the SSO went under and the university took those on. So we thought it was very important to talk to the parents of those students who were so intimately involved in this type of music and get an idea from them and get some feedback. And it's been very, as we were talking yesterday, I think it's helped people to get some of the emotions out about the loss of the SSO and help us to move forward in a positive way. So we've talked to those parents. We talked to some seniors at the Nottingham just down the road. That was one of the first ones we did. And getting some really good feedback from the public in terms of, again, what people are willing to pay money for to go see and to get an idea of, you know, who is the audience that is coming out to see these concerts, and identifying, you know, different groups within Central New York that really haven't been targeted to come out to concerts. So one of the next public forums we're looking at to do is at the Fellowship Temple down in the Outer Comstock area, which is not too far from here, with Pastor H. Bernard Alex, having discussions with him about having another forum in his church, which is a African-American black gospel church, talking to those folks and seeing what they had to say. Because that's a part of the community that really, I think, has been overlooked in styles of music, the gospel style of music, which I think is very popular, which personally, I think it's something that needs to be a regular in the repertoire of symphonic music and popular music for that matter. So those are some of the things we've been doing with the center. As we move forward into next semester and we're wrapping up this semester, we'll be looking to get more student involvement. We have we surveyed about 150 of our music students. And of course, at the Settner School, we have music education, music industry, and performance students and composition students. So we have a wide range of musicians that we talk to get their feedback on music and programming specifically. So those are a few of the clients that we have been working with. And again, as we move forward, we're looking to get more student involvement. And eventually there will be a full-time director of this position. Right now I'm the interim director, as she introduced us. I'm a performing musician. I play all different kinds of styles of music. I'm a member of the local 78 American Federation of Musicians. I've been a member in good standing for 10 years with the Musicians Union. I played with the Syracuse Symphony a number of times. I'm good friends with many, many of the musicians in town, and I'm very blessed to get to play a lot of different styles of music, which has helped me because I play so many different styles that I've been able to stay employed. Which is one of the, you know, to be frank, is one of the issues. You know, you need musicians who have a broad range, and obviously you need to be experts in some styles and then have other styles around that. So I've been very blessed to have a very diverse career in music, from symphonic music to playing at the Dinosaur Barbecue to playing at Shifty's to playing at Syracuse Stage. So I've played in a lot of different groups, and so I think that was one of the reasons that I was asked to help get the center going and give it legs and get it going, is because of my networking in the community with so many different aspects of music and so many different types of musicians and the people that I've worked with. So that's a little bit about what I've been doing with the Center for Live Music.
That's such an amazing program because, as someone who's new to the area, I just moved here at the end of August and who's been involved in the business for 25 plus years. I have to tell everyone here that for a university to create this kind of program is something that you just don't see very often, and I think it really expresses a perspective about the importance of culture and music in this community. And I think it's a very important point. And I think that same commitment to the community, to understanding the role of culture in the community, and the commitment to culture itself and looking forward is also expressed through the Janklow Arts Program. And that's a brand new program that I've come here to launch. And the Janklow Arts Program on one level could be seen as a graduate program in arts management. For those who aren't familiar with the field, it's one of those really narrow niche fields that is all around us, but nobody really ever thinks about it. I mean, I certainly never really thought about it until I got into the business. We go to shows, we go to performances, and I still remember it suddenly dawning on me one day that, wait a minute, somebody other than the musicians on stage is making a living doing this. You know, those musicians didn't just show up by themselves, and the doors to that building just didn't open by themselves. And as Josh was talking about with the center, those things, lots of people can perform, lots of people have really great ideas for performances, but there's a huge gap between the idea and making it reality, and that's what really stops a lot of good things in its tracks. Just the simple things like, how do I market a show? The questions that he was saying they were dealing with the orchestras. Who is our audience? Why are they attending? How do I physically promote the show? How do I rent a building? All of these kind of management issues come into play. And that's the purpose of the Janklow program on one level, is to train the arts managers of tomorrow. And the interesting thing is that the scale of these organizations has gotten much, much larger over time. It wasn't that long ago when we talked about arts management, we talked really about running a theater company or running an opera company, and you'd do your five or six performances and that was it. What we've seen over time, though, is, and it goes back to my opening remarks, is the growth in the industry and the involvement in the arts. And arts management has now become arts leadership. It's a much more complicated field. It's one that requires a lot of different skills, and it's one that has a huge impact on the community. And so on the one level, it's running large performing arts centers, like the Broward Center in Florida that I ran, with five different performing arts centers, more than 1,000 performances a year, over 1,000 volunteers. These get to be very complicated organizations that we're running that involve issues of intellectual property and creation of new works and labor law and all kinds of. And so we need managers that understand these issues. It also gets into the area, though, that as we want the arts to become involved in our communities, when we want the arts to be more than just the organization that puts a show on the stage, we need managers that also understand tourism, that understand education. As Josh was saying, it wasn't just about the symphony, it was about the youth orchestra and the string orchestra that was endangered by this. So it's about having managers that understand these larger commitments. It's about having managers that understand that when you renovate something like the Landmark Theater, that it affects the businesses around you, it affects the downtown, or that Syracuse Stage affects businesses around you with people going out for dinner at night beforehand. So the Janklow Arts Leadership Program is going to involve, it's an interdisciplinary program that will involve not only people that have a background in the arts, but it also involves the Maxwell School in Public Administration and the Whitman School of Management with business classes and Newhouse with marketing and communications. And as a result of it, we want people that know how to manage the purpose-driven organization, entrepreneurial in spirit, but mission-driven in their intent. And it's no longer, because we no longer live in the age where we can sit there and draw the neat boundaries and say, those guys are doing commercial theater, they're all about the money, but I'm all about the mission, and somehow by a miracle, the money will come in. We all see that that doesn't happen anymore. You know, there's that, in Shakespeare in Love, I was struck by the beginning of that movie because it seemed to describe what the field of arts management was like. For those of you that remember the movie, the theater producer, and I thought it was a very accurate of some theater producers that I know, was being tortured by his creditor and saying, you owe me the money. And he says, yes, yes, I know, I'll pay you back. He said, you owe me the money. I know, I'll pay you back. Well, how will you do that? I don't know, it's a miracle. And that's kind of how we've approached the field of arts management a lot. I've got this great idea. It's going to be wonderful. Come on, Judy. Let's sweep out the barn. We'll do a show. How will we pay for it? I don't know. It's going to be a miracle. You know, it doesn't work that way. So we need to create the next generation of managers. We need to create the managers for Arts Management 2.0. And that's what the Janklow program is about. And that's what, in effect, the larger issue here today is all about, and that our respective programs represent, is what is the right role for the arts in society? How do we make a sustainable arts model? How do we keep the arts alive, but doing so in a way that makes sense culturally, that makes sense financially, that makes sense socially? And so both of these programs that you just heard about today, on the one level, you could look at them and say, oh, that's really nice. They're just some little management programs. They're going to help people manage better. But what these programs really present is a much more profound shift in the cultural life in America and a very profound commitment on the part of the university to culture and all that it represents. So that's my little spiel, and we'd be happy to entertain questions, comments, thoughts about the arts in general, even if they're not about our program specifically. And so we'll open up the door.
Thank you very much. Josh, you mentioned helping the entrepreneurs who wanted to create a new venue. And I guess this question is actually for both of you to the extent that you haven't been here very long, Mark. Do we have enough venues in Syracuse or, you know, of various sizes? I mean, I don't know if you've assessed that yet, but, you know, we have the Red House and we have churches and whatever, and we have the On Center.
I do. I think within Syracuse proper and within the surrounding Central New York, I think there's fantastic venues. Of course, the Landmark Theater that just reopened, I think is fantastic. It has a lot of charm to it with the art. As soon as you walk in, it has a charm to it that is unique, I think, to Syracuse. So I think that's one. There's certainly Krause Heinz Theater is a well-utilized place. There's definitely challenges with that because of its downtown location, as is with the Landmark. So those are challenges you have to look at. There certainly on campus at Syracuse University, Goldstein Auditorium, Settner Auditorium in Krause College. You look outside of there in Utica, the theater there. So I think there's a lot, and those are just the larger auditoriums. And then there's certainly many, many smaller venues. You mentioned the Red House. There's places like Jazz Central, which is a fantastic not-for-profit group. I've done a lot of performances there. It is very, makes it very, very easy for smaller groups, theater groups, small ensembles to get in and play, because you have to put very little money up front and you can make your money back. So this is playing devil's advocate a little bit in terms of the sustainability of the arts, this idea of, God forbid, artists actually making a profit. So places like Jazz Central, it makes it very, very, it makes it the odds of success for an artist to be able to come in and present whatever their art is, be it a theater group or a comedy show or music, that they can actually come out with money in their pocket. So I think in terms of venues, we have a lot. There's a lot to offer. Now, you can talk to some of the different musicians and say, ah, oh, the Landmark Theater, I hate the acoustics there. Oh, or there's this and that. And there's certainly anywhere you present music, there's going to be challenges, the logistical side of it. However, I think that there are plenty of choices and plenty of places to offer concerts.
I just want to amplify what Josh said, because I think he touched on an important point in how we think about venues. And there's a tendency, because venues and theaters are the physical thing that we can all look at and sort of get a touch and feel for, we think it's about the building a lot of time. But Josh really touched on the important point when he talked about Jazz Central. It's not always about the building, yet it's about the experience that you create for the artist and for the audience. And I want to emphasize for the artist. I've run lots of different buildings. That's been my business. I've run buildings that are acoustically perfect, and it's a terrible experience for the audience, and it's a terrible place to perform. I've run places that by every standard no one should want to go into. They sound terrible. They're difficult for the artist, but people love being there. And it's because it's the total package. The questions for the artists are, can we actually make money there? Can the promoter make money there? Can the audience get to the building easily? Are there other things around the building to do? I mean, one of the things that we forget about is that as important as the building might be and the theater, it's the restaurants and the bars and other places nearby, because arts are a social experience. And I've seen beautiful theaters, absolutely gorgeous, perfect theaters in the middle of a university campus that's 10 miles outside of town, and they never get used. And I've seen wrecks of a hall in that same city that you look at and you think they should be closed down, and the audience loves them because it's the social experience. So when we talk about venues, I would agree with Josh, there are lots of great venues here, and they accommodate a wide range of cultural activity. And so I don't know that venues are necessarily the issue so much as how we think about them and the social dynamics.
I have a wife and two little boys and run a small business, but I'm also a recreational musician. I took 20 years off after high school and started playing saxophone again with an amateur rock band. And I will never play in any group that has symphony in its name, but I enjoy it very much. And I wonder if you see a connection between that participatory sort of recreational musicianship and somebody who's willing maybe to spend $50, $75 on a ticket, if there's a connection there. And if so, does it make sense to foster that sort of culture in a community to encourage some of the things you all are working on?
Absolutely. I think you've touched on one of the things that, oddly enough, in the arts in the last 30 or 40 years, we haven't done a good enough job on, that at the same time we've seen an explosion in arts organizations and a growth in the fine arts, in an odd sort of way we've kind of neglected the recreational musician, the recreational artist. And I'll look to, because I go to a lot of arts conferences and I hear people complaining about the you know, all the sports world gets all, you know, these professional teams that are out to make money still get all these subsidies. Why can't we in the arts get it? Well, one of the reasons is that those teams do a great job of fostering the recreational players. They get people to identify with the sport. They don't demand that you go to see the team. You just identify with it. You know, my little boy, when he was in T-ball, for heaven's sakes, the Florida Marlins. We were living in Florida at the time. The Florida Marlins gave every kid a little tiny bat and ball bag. You know, it cost them a buck and a half probably. But the fact was, even though my son is playing T-ball and is never ever going to be a professional baseball player, if you ask me at that time, it's like, oh yeah, I'm a fan of the Marlins. I like baseball. And we identified with the sport, and the Marlins knew that. In the arts, we don't do a really good job of it, and that's why I made the comment earlier about the youth orchestra and the string being so important. I think as arts organizations, we have an obligation, and we've missed the opportunity to fully embrace, to fully engage, and to fully encourage the, quote, recreational artist. And so you're absolutely right. That should play a lot. It should play to a lot of our thinking in terms of how we define major arts organizations, as opposed to defining the relationship as one of ticket buyer or donor. It should be, are you a fellow participant at some level in the art form?
I think it's a great question. One of the things we've been finding in our research with the public. A common theme has been this invisible veil that exists from the stage to the audience. And it really certainly depends on the style of music. When we talk about symphonic music, a lot of audiences come because they know that this veil exists, right? And this is one of the things that appealed to me at a young age about the stage. I love being on the stage because, you know, I like going to see stuff, but I like to be up there. And there's something about it. But so people go to see concerts, and some people go because they like that. And they like to have that distance between the musicians, that they're doing this mysterious thing and sending these invisible vibrations into the air that sound pleasing to us. And there's that mystery to it. But then there's, I think, a growing number of people who want more interaction between what's going on the stage and what's happening in the audience, whether it's audience participation. I'm thinking of a show like The Lion King, if you had a chance to see the touring act of The Lion King. I don't know if there's a touring show or any Broadway show that could top that in terms of the interaction with the audience and getting them moving. So I think what you're saying in terms of recreational musicians, I think that's part of breaking down that invisible veil. The more people you have coming to your concerts, and like he's saying, investing in people wanting to have music be a part of their lives more than just playing the radio or listening to iTunes, I think is crucial to getting more people involved. So I think you have a very good point.
Thank you very much for helping lead the arts forward in our community. If I could look back for a minute just to better understand, the Syracuse Symphony Orchestra, if they were totally sold out for every performance, would they have been financially viable?
We've been here a short time, but I can tell you the answer is no. And that's the case with every, in fact, the growth of the nonprofit arts industry in the last 40 years is precisely because of that. The typical orchestra, opera company only gets about maybe 30, 40, 50% of their revenue from ticket sales. And what's happened over time is we've created an unsustainable model, thinking that good intentions, good ideas, highest musical standards alone would be enough to make things, to sustain things. And those are all very important, but I think what we've discovered is that at the end of the day, the arts are like any other business. We're still making a transaction. And you've seen it with independent bookstores, for example, that, well, I have a good idea, it's a good environment, I have noble thoughts, but you know what? The customer, it's still a business, it's still a transaction. And we can't escape that. That's not to say that the arts should only be about money, but we have to think about those things. And we especially have to think about it precisely because of the fact that you can sell out every ticket and you still can't make it. You know, the Performing Arts Center that I ran in Florida, the Broward Center, had one of the highest levels of earned income in the country. We operate at about a 92% level of earned income, which meant that for every dollar it took to run the place, we earned 92%. Ticket sales were only about 75%. We still had other sources of revenue because we operated the parking, we operated the bars, we operated catering. You know, we were really just a big parking garage that did really good shows. And so my programming director didn't like to think of it that way, but when you looked at how the money worked, that was kind of how it worked out. But the point of that is that here we were. You know, we were some of the best in the country at making money, and I still had to raise $3 million a year to keep the doors open. And that was considered really, really good. Now, if we were just a standalone opera or symphony, that number would have gone up exponentially. And so that's where part of the problem. And that gets back to tie back to what Josh just said and the question that was asked earlier. That's why it's so important for us to understand that we have to start thinking of our organizations as community institutions. And we as managers, that's part of what I'm trying to train the next generation for, have to understand that it's not sufficient just to think of the programming and the ticket sales, but how do we create a different value proposition for the community? How do we monetize that proposition? And what does that sustainable form look like? And part of it is we have to be engaged with the entire community. We have to engage the recreational musicians. We have to engage the downtown businesses that don't care about art for art's sake.
Just to counter that a little bit and play the devil's advocate, I think it's important to, we're talking about arts organizations, and we when we say arts organizations, I think we start to assume high arts. We're talking symphonic music, art, visual art, things that are maybe a little esoteric, maybe a little bit different than popular music. Now, we look at popular music. Here are musicians who you can look at country, rock and roll, hip-hop, I won't say jazz because they're not as profitable, but if you look at what is popular today, these are musicians who are out there making, some of them, quite a lot of money. And record companies who are making quite a bit of money, and they're out there touring the country, touring different parts of the globe. It's a very different model. They don't necessarily have a corporate benefactor or a private benefactor that is supporting them. Certainly the record companies have the capital to help them up front, but they make that money back. So this is, I think, important to look at in terms of contrasting what we're talking about with arts organizations in this model of you are absolutely dependent on corporate dollars, on private funding of people who have a lot of money, who have their own vision, as we were talking about earlier, who these donors certainly have their own vision of what they want to see their dollars being used towards. Counter that with popular artists who really have their own vision, are out there doing it, taking it to the people, and being financially very successful. Now, of course, some artists will argue, well, this is popular music. This is not music of the highest quality. That's certainly a very relative term. So I'm just kind of playing devil's advocate a little bit there as someone who has worked in many of these different fields.
Josh, I can't emphasize enough how important that point is that Josh just made, because that really also addresses the whole perspective of shifting understanding of what the arts are all about and how culture is delivered. To reinforce his point, for too long we have made arts and culture synonymous with large established arts organizations. And one of the great things that's happening is that we're beginning to understand that, wait a minute, culture is not defined by the opera, ballet, and symphony anymore, that there's a lot of culture in a community independently of those organizations. The other thing that's happened is our aspirations sort of got out of whack with our pocketbooks. That what happens in the popular sector, as Josh said, is that people start out, and it's not that these artists don't have grand visions, but immediately they go, wait a minute, that's a $20 vision, and I've got $2 in my pocket, so I got to find another way to achieve it. And eventually they get to the point where they can. In the nonprofit arts world, we sort of start out with this $20 vision and we say, well, that's okay. Again, it's a miracle. Somehow it'll be funded. That's what we got to change. It's not that the vision is bad, but we've created these unsustainable institutions, and we've unfortunately made them synonymous with culture in general. You know, the Florida Philharmonic went bankrupt about 10 years ago, and it was really interesting because people said, oh my gosh, it's, you know, we're going to be losing classical music in South Florida. We did a study at the Performing Arts Center the following year, and we found there were actually more performances of classical music the following year than there was when the Philharmonic was around, because all those musicians started forming smaller ensembles, performing more frequently in churches. So more people saw more classical music after the orchestra went bankrupt than before, paradoxically. Now, yes, we lost the symbolic aspect of having an orchestra in town or a nationally known orchestra. We lost the ability to do maybe large Mahler pieces and a few selected pieces, but classical music didn't die. In fact, the largest listening body for radio in South Florida are the classical radio stations down there now. So I think it's important to really think about what Josh just said, because we don't want to make art synonymous with big arts organizations.
I love seeing people get excited about their new jobs, and you seem to be those kinds of people. What especially about Syracuse made you excited about your jobs, your new jobs?
Well, for me, I've been excited about my job for 25 plus years. I'm particularly excited about this new incarnation of my job. The thing that made me, that really got me excited, was that there's a sense that goes back hundreds of years in this region of social engagement and activism. It's not. It's this idea that the arts matter in our life, not just because of the content, but because of what we achieve in the larger society. And this university and this region has a history of social engagement and social ideas, and I really like that a lot. I like the fact that this was an interdisciplinary program here, that it really recognized that the arts are not just purely about the content and not just purely about the business. And I really like my colleagues here. I've had a great time meeting people like Josh. There's a lot of really smart people here that have really great ideas and that are willing to look at forward to the next generation of what the arts mean, not looking backwards.
Yeah, for myself, you know, I've lived in Syracuse now. This is my 11th year. I'm originally from Houston, Texas, grew up there, and have lived in many different parts of the country. But I've lived here now my 11th year. And so for me, this new interim position is just on top of all the other teaching that I'm already doing. So I really enjoyed it. It was a challenge. It was an opportunity to look at music and research and entrepreneurship in a different way. And kind of helped me recognize a lot of things that I was already doing in terms of having a hustle and getting out there and getting gigs and working with different groups. And, you know, some people might say, well, you know, you teach at the university, so you're very highbrow or whatever. But at the same time, I'm very blue collar because I'm out there hauling my own drums. And nobody is, you know, it's very rare that anybody sets up any equipment for me. And I haul my own stuff. So it's why my mother wanted me to play the flute. You can put your flute in your bag and be gone, but I'm always hauling equipment. So for me, this was an opportunity to build on what I've been doing musically. And then when this aspect of representing the Philharmonic came about, you know, I've definitely taken a lot of heat from in the public, in the papers, in blogs, and I welcome it. I think it's great. I think everyone should be critical of what they're seeing, and they should question it, because you know, iron sharpens iron, and we need the public needs to be critical of what's going on and not just stand idly by and say, oh yeah, that's fine, just let it go. Question it, go after it. Now obviously there's a protocol for that, and some people have crossed the line in terms of personal attacks on me, and that's fine too. I welcome that in terms of a challenge. So I think that was part of the draw for me when I took on this interim role. At least this element of representing the Phil was, you know, in what small way I can, I this idea of moving forward and helping the group to move forward and helping to be a healer in some ways, to let people vent their frustrations and get these emotions out, and hopefully to help my fellow musicians be employed in a way that is sustainable for them as well. So I think that's
Just going back to your program, the Janklow program, you know, talking about sustainability, is one of the components of that program teaching your graduate students about development and good stewardship? And, I mean, can you elaborate on that?
Absolutely. I mean, as much as we talk about entrepreneurship and the business side of it, the fact is that in some fashion you're dealing with outside investors, whether those are sponsors, whether those are donors, and so development is absolutely a part that the students have to understand. They have to understand the fundraising process, but what I also want them to begin to understand is the nature of these relationships, the motivation, and where this all leads, and how the boundaries that used to be so clear-cut are a lot fuzzier now. When you start looking at corporations making, quote, donations, is it a donation or is it a sponsorship? Because sponsorship, somebody wants something. They're buying something. And even donations, to some extent, we're buying something. When I donate to things, I donate because I believe that that organization is going to accomplish something that I value. So, in effect, I'm outsourcing to another group. And I think it's important for the students to understand that. So that's part of the interdisciplinary concept behind the program. Absolutely.
Two questions. The first one fairly quick. In the Janklow program, it sounds like it's focused primarily on performing arts as opposed to visual arts. So if you could clarify that. Second question, we all know there's a European model where there's a lot more funding for the arts and culture that come from government and from the taxpayer. And I think maybe 20 years ago there was some thought that we could move the American model more in that direction. But it seems that it's turned actually 180 degrees the other way. The funding of government for the arts seems to be on the decline. And I guess I'm just asking if that's the same observation you'd have.
The first question, actually, I'm sorry if I gave the impression that it's more the performing arts, because it's really all of the art forms. And in fact, one of the things that I think is going to distinguish this program as we look forward is that it's not always just, when I talk about arts leadership, it's not even always about managing arts organizations. That's why the title of the program is more descriptive, I think, than many realize at first, because arts management is really focused on managing arts organizations. When I think of arts leadership, especially in this day and age, graduates of this program could just as easily end up working for a corporation in their sponsorship department, because a lot of the leadership in the arts right now is being driven by what corporations decide to fund. Or they could end up working for a tourism board somewhere, because, for example, in Miami, the Performing Arts Center in Miami gets $12 million a year from the tourism people. You could argue that the biggest leaders in the arts are really the tourism people that made the decision to make that funding. So it's not confined to the performing arts. It's not even necessarily confined to the arts, period. As far as the funding model goes, you're absolutely right. Government funding on all levels is being scaled back. Some states have completely eliminated their arts boards. And ironically, what's happening right now, too, is that even in Europe, government funding is being scaled back. A couple years ago, I spent some time in London talking with arts organizations there, because as government funding is being cut back, they're actually looking to America to say, how do we deal with this? We don't have any experience raising money. We don't have any experience even thinking entrepreneurially. We've had the luxury of having very low price tickets and people just come. Suddenly we have to manage differently.
Hi. I'm delighted that you both are making a living in the realm of the arts. And I guess that's what my question is, particularly about music. It seemed like when the Syracuse Symphony shut down, the musicians weren't making a ton of money already. They'd made a lot of concessions, and their income had been cut back, and it was kind of tough for them to make a living without doing a lot of other things. And we've got this internet and online world where it seems like the expectation in a lot of people is that they don't have to pay for music anymore. They don't have to pay to listen anymore. And there just seems to be a lot of turbulence in this field. And I just wonder what advice you would give to a musician starting out about how they can expect to make a living. Do they have to become entrepreneurs? Does every artist have to be an entrepreneur now? Do they need a kind of a niche at a university, like many authors have, professorships? How can they expect to make a living? Are we getting to some clarity about how music people can get paid for their music? Are we still in that turbulent era? Or can really people still make a living in music?
Let me just briefly address that and turn it over to Josh as the musician. You're absolutely right. There's a lot more turbulence, and that's a great term, in culture and the arts and entertainment in general. And it's not just musicians and artists that are struggling with that, but corporations and administrators and executives all along. I mean, you look at Warner Brothers in the music industry, you look at the publishing industry, everything has been turned upside down because of technology, the internet, a variety of things. I don't have studies to back this up, but my guess would be that for everyone that has suffered by it, there's been somebody else discovering a new way to make money by it. So turbulence is exactly it. I don't know that it's either good or bad. It's just very, very different, and we've gone from a system that was relatively stable for generations to one that is highly unstable and discovering new ways of looking at it. So I think there's still money to be made, but you just have to go about it differently, and your expectations are very different. But I'll let the musician talk.
Yeah, I absolutely feel musicians can make a living. Now, how do you do that? Certainly when we talk about orchestral musicians, those are certainly the most stable positions. Now, they're very choice. They're very rare. We have, obviously, musicians every year graduating from conservatories, music schools. Right now, we're just talking about orchestral musicians, people studying the Western European music. So every year you have more and more people into the pool for less and less jobs. So what in the world are those people doing? Well, frankly, there's the ones that get the jobs and the ones that don't. I know some who ended up as realtors, some who have ended up in different fields selling insurance and other things and still supplementing what they're doing by doing other work as they still are making music in the symphonic world. So I think those positions are definitely the most stable, as instable as they are. Those are groups, you know, if you get into a large, you know, orchestra, you can have benefits like somebody working in any normal business corporation, that you have benefits, you have a pension. And that was certainly some of the issues that were at hand as the SSO went under and continue to be. Now, you look beyond that. Again, we're kind of using this assumption. We say musician, there seems to be this assumption that we're just talking about orchestra musicians. And there are so many other styles of musicians out there that are making a living. Schools like the Berklee School of Music in Boston or the Manhattan School. Even at Eastman, there's fantastic jazz programs. So different styles of music. I think that probably at this point the students who probably have a brighter future in terms of making a living are students who can bridge those gaps of playing, like myself, playing many broad styles of music. I think the days are over of someone who graduates from your program that all they can do is play one very, very specific style of music, because I think it's very limiting. Some might argue, well, then that takes away from the quality of the music. I would argue against that, because I think as the economy becomes more and more global, so does the music. This is some of the things we've been seeing in our research and hearing from some folks, is that part of the sustainability of the arts, not only music, but is we need, you know, if you look at a place like ArtRage, I don't know how many people, if you go to ArtRage or if you know about them, that place has got stuff going all the time. They're turning over exhibits all the time, exhibits from South America, people from America, different parts of North America. They're constantly changing and having different styles and different artists in there from different parts of the world. And I think that's one of the things that musicians really, like when I talk to young musicians about this, they need to start learning styles of music from other parts of the world. Western Europe you know, has a great tradition, and but it's not the only tradition. So I'm kind of biased because I play a lot of jazz music, and I'm a very fierce proponent of America's music, which is jazz. Of course, it's not our popular music anymore, but musicians who are studying that, I think, are probably going to have a leg up on a musician who all they play is just that. Does that answer your question?
I was wondering what the chances were of the Syracuse Symphony doing a Phoenix and Rising from the Ashes.
Just to make sure I understand your question, if the Syracuse Symphony can do a Phoenix and Rise from the Ashes, well, unfortunately, because they filed for Chapter 7, the name Syracuse Symphony can no longer be used. That organization is gone. So can an orchestra come back in Central New York? Absolutely. And that's what the Phil is trying to do. Symphony Syracuse is definitely, they're presenting a ton of concerts. So I guess the analogy of the Phoenix, it's maybe a different set of ashes because it's not quite from the same pool. But absolutely, symphonic music will come back. It's not going to be exactly, I don't think, in my opinion, it can't be run in the same way that it was.
Uh-huh. Do you have a question, Shirley?
Well, it really isn't a question, except, and I've been so involved with this in the respect that my husband, Murray Bernthal, never had an organization that had a board. And he felt very strongly that you get a board and it becomes a good thing for the person who is elevated to that position and doesn't necessarily know anything about the music. Now, I came from Broward before I married Murray, and one of the things he said was that the symphony in Broward County at the time was the main reason that they built the Performing Arts Center down there, and they had first choice. Where up here, it was not, they said the symphony was always second choice. Now, he started famous artists because he thought they're going to be more important, and because he got the shows from other places. He and his wife both performed in the original Syracuse Symphony and helped put it together, and also were the reason that the Landmark Theater was not torn down, even though they didn't go on with that because they were still using the On Center. I think people do need, I've heard a lot of talk about what people want, and this is important, but people want what they hear that is good. And I don't know what more, if the symphony comes back and goes in the Landmark, what's going to happen to our Hahn Center?
I do want to say that we still do plan on having a program about the Philharmonic in the next semester.
I think you've in your question and statement, you've really captured the complexity of our business, that it's not a simple question of, well, does the symphony play or not, and it's not an isolated question of what's that venue. The kind of organizations we have, the kind of venues we have, how music, how culture is presented are all wrapped up and interwoven. And as you pointed out, the Broward Center was built because the orchestra needed a better place to play. So there are these interrelationships that we can't escape. And I don't know that I have necessarily a concise comment on what you said, but I think what you said in the broad range and what you illustrated is very important. The other comment that I'd like to make relative to that is that, and all the comments today really start illustrating this, and it goes back to Josh's comment too about musicians, that when we talk about culture and the arts in the broad sense, there are so many different ways that we deliver culture to people. There are so many different ways that we experience it, and it's very important that we don't get locked into the idea of cultural management and cultural benefits as being synonymous with any one kind of organization. I mean, one of the things we have to think about, you know, we talk about museums and orchestras. Relatively speaking, those are pretty recent delivery phenomenon. I mean, the museum, as we understand it, isn't really much more than 100 years old or so. The orchestra, as we understand it, and the orchestra as a community institution broadly based in America isn't really much more than 100 years old or so. So this idea that we sit here and say, well, this is the way life is supposed to be, you know, it wasn't always like that, and it won't be. So this sense of turbulence, it's always ongoing, and sometimes you just experience a little bit more of it than other times. But it's kind of like earthquake zones in L.A. You know, you live there for 20 years and nothing happens, and you think, oh, it's stable until something happens. You know, the arts are kind of like that. We reach these periods of stability, and then technology comes in, economics comes in, things change. And why should we in the arts be any different than the business world? Businesses come and go all the time. And arts organizations, let's be honest, they are businesses, and they come and go for a lot of reasons that have nothing to do with art, and it's a shame when we lose them. We want art in the community, but we have to understand that the business is, art is eternal, art is everywhere. The specific business is not eternal, and that specific business has a lot of other factors. And that's really what the Janklow program is all about. How do we keep art through the delivery system of various businesses?
Well, ma'am, she was mentioning about some of the different venues, the On Center, the Krauss Heinz Theater. Some of the feedback we've been getting, a common theme that has come through a lot of the different folks we've talked to, is the idea of continuing what the SSO did in terms of bringing the music to the people, instead of this idea of, okay, we're going to play here, you all come to us. And the SSO did this. They did a lot of runouts to Utica, to Watertown, sometimes to Oswego, different spots. That's one way to do it. And what we're getting feedback in our research from the public is there should be more of that, and people will welcome more of that. Some of that might, because of the venues, manifest itself in smaller ensembles going out and doing that. But this idea of bringing the music to the people instead of presenting it and waiting for them to come back. So in terms of what you're talking about with the venues, I think those venues will always be used, but there'll be others as well to help bridge that gap and to foster.
Excellent. Thank you, Josh DeCaney and Mark Nurenhausen.